Hauling in the dredge by hand was severe work, and on the 24th we used the Girling tractor motor, which brought in 500 fathoms of line in 30 minutes, including stops. One stop was due to water having run over the friction gear and frozen. It was a day or two later that we heard a great yell from the floe and found Clark dancing about and shouting Scottish war cries. He had secured his first complete specimen of an Antarctic fish, apparently a new species. Mirages were frequent. Barrier cliffs appeared all around us on the 29th, even in places where we knew there was deep water. Bergs and pack are thrown up in the sky and distorted into the most fantastic shapes. They climb trembling upwards, spreading out into long lines at different levels, then contract and fall down, leaving nothing but an uncertain, wavering smudge which comes and goes. Presently the smudge swells and grows, taking shape until it presents the perfect inverted reflection of a berg on the horizon, the shadow hovering over the substance. More smudges appear at different points on the horizon. These spread out into long lines till they meet, and we are girdled by lines of shining snow cliffs, laved at their bases by waters of illusion in which they appear to be faithfully reflected. So the shadows come and go silently, melting away finally as the sun declines to the west. We seem to be drifting helplessly in a strange world of unreality. It is reassuring to feel the ship beneath one's feet and to look down at the familiar line of kennels and igloos on the solid floe. The floe was not so solid as it appeared. We had reminders occasionally that the greedy sea was very close, and that the floe was but a treacherous friend, which might open suddenly beneath us. Towards the end of the month I had our store of seal meat and blubber brought aboard. The depth, as recorded by a sounding on the last day of March, was 256 fathoms. The continuous shoaling from 606 fathoms in a drift of 39 miles north 26 degrees west in 30 days was interesting. The sea shoaled as we went north, either to east or to west, and the fact suggested that the contour lines ran east and west, roughly. Our total drift between January 19th, when the ship was frozen in, and March 31st, a period of 71 days, had been 95 miles in a north 80 degrees west direction. The icebergs round us had not changed their relative positions. The sun sank lower in the sky, the temperatures became lower, and the Endurance felt the grip of the icy hand of winter. The northeasterly gales in the early part of April assisted to consolidate the pack. The young ice was thickening rapidly, and though leads were visible occasionally from the ship, no opening of a considerable size appeared in our neighbourhood. In the early morning of April 1st, we listened again for the wireless signals from Port Stanley. The crew had lashed 3 20-foot rickers to the mastheads in order to increase the spread of our aerials, but still we failed to hear anything. The rickers had to come down subsequently, since we found that the gear could not carry the accumulating weight of rime. Soundings proved that the sea continued to shoal as the Endurance drifted to the northwest. The depth on April 2nd was 262 fathoms, with a bottom of glacial mud. 4 weeks later, a sounding gave 172 fathoms. The presence of grit in the bottom samples towards the end of the month suggested that we were approaching land again. The month was not uneventful. During the night of the 3rd, we heard the ice grinding to the eastward, and in the morning we saw that young ice was rafted 8 to 10 feet high in places. This was the first murmur of the danger that was to reach menacing proportions in later months. The ice was heard grinding and creaking during the 4th, and the ship vibrated slightly. The movement of the floe was sufficiently pronounced to interfere with the magnetic work. I gave orders that accumulations of snow, ice, and rubbish alongside the Endurance should be shovelled away, so that in case of pressure there would be no weight against the topsides to check the ship rising above the ice. All hands were busy with pick and shovel during the day, and moved many tons of material. Again, on the 9th, there were signs of pressure. Young ice was piled up to a height of 11 feet astern of the ship, and the old floe was cracked in places. The movement was not serious, but I realized that it might be the beginning of trouble for the expedition. We brought certain stores aboard and provided space on deck for the dogs in case they had to be removed from the floe at short notice. We had run a 500-fathom steel wire round the ship, snow huts and kennels, with a loop out to the lead ahead where the dredge was used. This wire was supported on ice pillars, and it served as a guide in bad weather when the view was obscured by driving snow and a man might have lost himself altogether. I had this wire cut in 5 places, since otherwise it might have been dragged across our section of the floe with damaging effect in the event of the ice splitting suddenly. The dogs had been divided into 6 teams of 9 dogs each. Wild, Crean, Macklin, McElroy, Marston and Hurley each had charge of a team, and were fully responsible for the exercising, training and feeding of their own dogs. They called in one of the surgeons when an animal was sick. We were still losing some dogs through worms, and it was unfortunate that the doctors had not the proper remedies. Worm powders were to have been provided by the expert Canadian dog driver I had engaged before sailing for the South, and when this man did not join the expedition, the matter was overlooked. We had 54 dogs and 8 pups early in April, but several were ailing, and the number of mature dogs was reduced to 50 by the end of the month. Our store of seal meat amounted now to about £5,000, and I calculated that we had enough meat and blubber to feed the dogs for 90 days without trenching upon the sledging rations. The teams were working well, often with heavy loads. The biggest dog was Hercules, who tipped the beam at £86. Samson was 11 pounds lighter, but he justified his name one day by starting off at a smart pace with a sledge carrying 200 pounds of blubber and a driver. A new berg that was going to give us some cause for anxiety made its appearance on the 14th. It was a big berg, and we noticed as it lay on the northwest horizon that it had a hummocky, crevassed appearance at the east end. During the day, this berg increased its apparent altitude and changed its bearing slightly. Evidently it was aground and was holding its position against the drifting pack. A sounding at 11 a.m. gave 197 fathoms, with a hard, stony or rocky bottom. During the next 24 hours, the Endurance moved steadily towards the crevassed berg, which doubled its altitude in that time. We could see from the masthead that the pack was piling and rafting against the mass of ice, and it was easy to imagine what would be the fate of the ship if she entered the area of disturbance. She would be crushed like an eggshell amid the shattering masses. Worsley was in the crow's nest on the evening of the 15th, watching for signs of land to the westward, and he reported an interesting phenomenon. The sun set amid a glow of prismatic colours on a line of clouds just above the horizon. A minute later, Worsley saw a golden glow which expanded as he watched it, and presently the sun appeared again and rose a semi-diameter clear above the western horizon. He hailed Crean, who, from a position on the floe 90 feet below the crow's nest, also saw the reborn sun. A quarter of an hour later, from the deck, Worsley saw the sun set a second time. This strange phenomenon was due to mirage or refraction. We attributed it to an ice pack to the westward when the band of open water had heated a stratum of air. The drift of the pack was not constant, and during the succeeding days the crevassed berg alternately advanced and receded as the Endurance moved with the flow. On Sunday, April 18th, it was only 7 miles distant from the ship. It is a large berg, about 3/4 of a mile long on the side presented to us, and probably well over 200 feet high. It is heavily crevassed, as though it once formed the serac portion of a glacier. 2 specially wide and deep chasms across it from southeast to northwest give it the appearance of having broken its back on the shoal ground. Huge masses of pressure ice are piled against its cliffs to a height of about 60 feet, showing the stupendous force that is being brought to bear upon it by the drifting pack. The berg must be very firmly aground. We swing the arrow on the current meter frequently and watch with keen attention to see where it will come to rest. Will it point straight for the berg, showing that our drift is in that direction? It swings slowly round. It points to the northeast end of the berg, then shifts slowly to the centre and seems to stop. But it moves again and swings 20 degrees clear of our enemy to the southwest. We notice that 2 familiar bergs, the Rampart Berg and the Peak Berg, have moved away from the ship. Probably they also have grounded or dragged on the shoal. A strong drift to the westward during the night of the 18th relieved our anxiety by carrying the Endurance to the lee of the crevassed berg, which passed out of our range of vision before the end of the month. We said goodbye to the sun on May 1st and entered the period of twilight that would be followed by the darkness of midwinter. The sun, by the aid of refraction, just cleared the horizon at noon and set shortly before 2 p.m. A fine aurora in the evening was dimmed by the full moon, which had risen on April 27th and would not set again until May 6th.